Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been 15 years since the 9/11 attacks. Where have we come in that time? In the last year alone, there have been attacks in Paris, Nice, Brussels, San Bernardino, Orlando, and well beyond. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Lawrence Wright has been watching it all from the beginning, thinking about how we've responded, what's driven the challenge, what we've become. This hour, On Point, Lawrence Wright and the terror years. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How do you look back on 9/11 now? How we responded, how the world has changed, what's coming? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Austin, Texas, is Lawrence Wright, staff writer for The New Yorker. He's been one of the country's most important voices illuminating the origins of 9/11 and its aftermath. Won a Pulitzer Prize for his 2006 work, The Looming Tower, and has spent years reporting from the U.S. and the Middle East. His new book, a collection of his work for The New Yorker, is The Terror Years, From Al-Qaeda to the Islamic State. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Lawrence Wright, welcome back to On Point.
Good to talk to you again, Tom.
It's good to have you here. Did you watch Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton last night at the Commander-in-Chief Forum in New York?
No, I missed that one.
You must have heard that Donald Trump said there that the big mistake was that we didn't take the oil fields in Iraq. We should have taken the oil, and that because we didn't, ISIS had all the resources lying around to become what it's become. Can you picture a scenario or how it might have played out if the U.S. had, I'm not sure exactly what it means, but had, I guess, militarily stepped in and taken Iraq's oil, taken control of it, taking ownership of it after the Iraq War?
Imagine the reaction of the Iraqi people to that. Our adventures in Iraq have been such a disaster in any case. And, of course, ISIS has many sources of revenue, kidnapping, and they even have taxes for fishing licenses and so on. They find ways to make money in many different ways. Downplaying our involvement in the Middle East, especially our reliance on oil and that kind of thing, would go a long way toward reducing our vulnerabilities.
15 years is such a long time. You've done so much reporting in that time, a lot of it amassed in this book, The Terror Years. How do you look back on 9/11 now? You've written about it so much, the origins, the aftermath. How do you look back on that as a pivot point in our country's history, in the world's history?
Oh, it was such a shock. You know, I remember when it happened that morning, and I was at a breakfast where we talked in Spanish, and I got in the car and I turned on NPR, and there was, a report of this airplane that had hit the Trade Center. And by the time I got home, the second plane had hit.
Yeah.
You know, you remember that, the planes were grounded and after that, and I couldn't get to New York. I was desperate to be involved in the story. And also the phones were down in New York for a while. So, but emails got through. So I sent a note to my editor at The New Yorker, David Remnick, saying, put me to work. And after lunch, the phones had come back, and we had a conference call, and there were New Yorker writers scattered all over the place in the middle of their stories. And I found a young man who had gotten out of the Trade Center. He had overslept. He slept through his stop on the subway. He had an appointment at 9 in the morning in the windows of the World Trade Center.
Wow.
And I had tracked him down by phone, and he had such a saga of trying to get out of the Trade Center after the planes hit. And that became the bookends for the famous black issue of The New Yorker.
Mm-hmm. Here's a little sound from that morning, the History Channel documentary, 9/11. It had raw footage from people across Manhattan who were witness to the planes crashing into the World Trade Center. And here's Caroline and Megan, two young women who were filming people jumping from the first tower, reacting to the attack on the second tower.
Another plane just crashed into the World Trade Center. Another plane hit it. A jet, a jumbo jet. I'm so scared. I'm leaving.
No, don't, Megan.
Bye. I love you.
Just a crazy, crazy feeling day. I was driving into New York that day. I had an appointment in Lower Manhattan and got a call from my wife saying something's going on, and ended up not going in. It was just a few days later, NPR called and it brought me into the whole NPR world the origins of this show itself there in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. Here's the sound of George Bush when he was visiting rescue workers at Ground Zero, famously with the bullhorn, speaking to the crowd.
I can hear you! I can hear you, the rest of the world hears you, and the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
And they did, in one war and then another, and we can lose count. Lawrence Wright, 15 years is time to just, I want to dig in with you. You come at this from so many angles, but what do you make of how overall we responded to this attack this day in the years since?
Well, to begin with, you know, we have established a lot of security measures that have made us safer. We've reorganized the intelligence community. There have been many things that we've done correctly, but the things that we did wrongly have count probably far more than that. We went into Afghanistan. We did have to do that. We had to break up al-Qaeda. We did not need to create a war against the Taliban. And we certainly didn't need to invade Iraq. That was a catastrophe. Those two wars are now, in Afghanistan and Iraq, the longest wars in American history. By some tallies, let's just set aside the bloodletting, differing accounts would say that $4 to $6 trillion of American treasure have been poured into those wars. To what effect? And the destabilization of Iraq and the region around Iraq, in part because of our adventures in that part of the world, have created, worldwide tumult. And no one's been really held to account for that. But it's been a disaster in that respect. And it's transformed our country in ways that are troubling to me. The creation of a security state, and I'm not faulting the intelligence agencies for the measures that they've taken, but it has taken us so far from the country that we were on September 10th. Young people now don't remember what it was like to be able to walk into an airport without going through security, or an office building without having your picture taken, or go visit the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia without having to take off your shoes and your belt. It's a totally different kind of America. Those little liberties that we took for granted have been compromised. And I'm afraid that America will be forgotten.
With all the essays in this collection, you come to that thought, your fear that it may become difficult for coming generations to even imagine what that freedom was like.
Yeah, I tell an anecdote about when I was in high school. I took my girlfriend to the airport in Dallas.
You grew up
in Dallas.
It's
called Love Field.
Yes,
sure. Actually called Love Field. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have any money, and so we went to the airport, and we walked out on the tarmac and climbed into some international jetliner that we thought had just come from Paris, and we sat down.
Literally just clambered into it?
Just walked in. The stewardesses, as we called them then, were cleaning up, and one of them brought us a snack, and we sat in the first-class compartment. And then we walked up in the FAA tower, And
the control tower. The door.
Yeah. Come on in, kids. Yeah. So we sat down. That was, I know it sounds, like a dream, but that was America. There was a sense of safety and community and trust that has been so breached that it's difficult to imagine the time when we can get back to that.
Where are we in the terror years? It's the name you've given to your new book. Are we coming out of these years? Are we putting them in the rearview mirror, or are we not?
Well, we're not yet. First of all, let me stipulate that I didn't realize that 15 years after 9/11, I would still be writing about terrorism. It's changed. The challenge has changed. The core al-Qaeda that struck us has been diminished, but its progeny are spreading, and there are more affiliates and actually more members of these radical groups than there were on 9/11. So it's certainly spread. And what concerns me is the template that al-Qaeda has created of, small, highly empowered groups or even individuals with technology that is becoming even more dangerous. When I was interviewing, I interviewed some people in the intelligence community, and I had a chance to talk to the guy who is the equivalent of Q in James Bond. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't show me any of the gear, unfortunately. Yep. But he said that what concerned him was that the same high school kids that can create computer viruses now will soon be able to create actual biological viruses. And we see people flying drones over the White House fence and so on. All this is technology that in some ways has been inspired by the war on terror, but actually comes back and poses a threat, I think, for us in the future.
Of course, the question is whether we've always had that impulse to take whatever was at hand and harm others with it in the style of terror we've seen in this 15 years now. Lawrence Wright, please stand by. The new collection of essays is The Terror Years, From Al-Qaeda to the Islamic State. Pulitzer Prize-winning New Yorker staff writer Lawrence Wright is with us. He's been reporting from the heart of this right from the beginning. The Looming Tower won the Pulitzer Prize, looking at the origins of the attacks on 9/11. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. It's been 15 years this Sunday since the attacks of 9/11. We're talking about where America, the world, have come, where we are in the age of terrorism, with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, writer Lawrence Wright, staff writer for the New Yorker magazine. He wrote The Looming Tower, about the origins of those attacks, al-Qaeda and the road to 9/11. His new collection of essays is The Terror Years, From al-Qaeda to the Islamic State. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Why is the whole world a stage for terror now? Has our response been wrong? Is there something bigger than our response unfolding here? What? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. And what does it mean? Lawrence Wright asks that a rising generation has never known a world without terror as a constant backdrop or threat. 800-423-TALK. We heard George W. Bush with the bullhorn on the rubble at 9/11 when the volunteers were still there working desperately to clean that up. By 2013, we heard President Obama, he was giving a drone policy address, and he reframed away from George Bush's war on terror.
We must define our effort not as a boundless global war on terror, but rather as a series of persistent, targeted efforts to dismantle specific networks of violent extremists that threaten America.
Persistent, targeted efforts, and a lot of that has worked, but by no means has it worked overall. Last November, more than 120 people killed in coordinated terror attacks in Paris. Eyewitness Charlie Pitt was at La Belle Epique Bistro in Paris, where 19 people were killed when two gunmen opened fire there. ISIS claimed responsibility for the attacks.
I thought it was a firecracker to start off with, and then it went on, it got louder. There was a whole pile of bodies, probably about seven on the left-hand side, and about four that had been sitting at the tables outside on the right-hand side.
And of course, it's come home again as well, not exactly 9/11 style, but here, December 2nd, last year, 14 killed, 22 seriously injured in a mass shooting, attempted bombing, that Christmas party in San Bernardino, California. Husband and wife shooters reported to be supporters of ISIS. On December 6th, President Obama had to address the nation from the Oval Office. He said terrorism is changing.
The terrorist threat has evolved into a new phase. As we've become better at preventing complex, multifaceted attacks like 9/11, terrorists turn to less complicated acts of violence, like the mass shootings that are all too common in our society. It is this type of attack that we saw at Fort Hood in 2009, in Chattanooga earlier this year, and now in San Bernardino.
The lists go on. Lawrence Wright has been watching. He joins us today from Austin, Texas. Lawrence Wright, many callers for you. Rich in Savannah, Georgia. Rich, you're on the air with Lawrence Wright.
Yes. Thank you, Tom. I'd like to say, first of all, I was a volunteer at Ground Zero, and we lost family there. I don't want to talk anymore about that part of it. What I do want to say is that in our response over the years, and where it has led us in our country to the divide that it has created amongst us for a myriad of different reasons. But the thing that alarms me the most at this point in time and dismays me the most is that there are 1.4 billion Muslims in the world. And the policy of demonizing Islam is one of the most, I think, one of the most dangerous tracks we can continue on. The bottom line here is that fundamentalism, whether it's Islamic fundamentalism, Buddhist fundamentalism, Hindu fundamentalism, Jewish fundamentalism, Christian fundamentalism, at one point or another, they all resort to the use of violence to one extent or another to get their to fulfill their aims. It's only when the larger society says that we will not tolerate this. And this is not going to end until the great silent majority of Islam finally says they have had enough and they're tired of these people bastardizing their faith.
Rich, let me take it to Lawrence Wright. I really appreciate your call from someone who was there working as a volunteer at Ground Zero. What do you make of Rich's analysis, Lawrence Wright?
Well, I agree that demonizing Islam as an overall religion is a miserable approach. But there are other factors at work. If you look at, let's take the example of France, who has a very large Muslim population, perhaps 10% of the country. 70% of the prisoners in France are Muslim. Now, what an extraordinary, just, you know,
is that true
about
overall
the,
of all people overall, in prisons and jails in France? 70% are Muslim.
70% are Muslim, and you know what a measure of alienation in that culture.
I mean, we know many are lower down the economic strata there, and live sometimes often outside the kind of certainly outside the cushy center of Paris and all that sort of France.
And, you know, these banlieues are, you know, the remnants of the colonial experience of European countries in North Africa and the Muslim world that America doesn't have. And so, there was for a long time this persistent segregated society full of young people with very few employment opportunities and no sense of attachment to the culture that they were living in. Well, that's not the case in the United States. We also have a significant Muslim population, but overall, it is better educated than the average American, makes a higher standard of income than the average American, and is less likely to go to prison than the average American. So the American experience has been far more successful for myriad reasons, one being that we don't have the colonial experience, and another is that we've done a far better job of inviting Muslims to participate in our culture.
But even with that, we have now tasted homegrown terrorism. Mm-hmm. The links, sometimes a little vague, how real, how sturdy, how deep they are, but the claims of links to ISIS have been there.
Yes, they have, and this, you know, this call for individual action is something that's new. I'm surprised that it took so long for ISIS and al-Qaeda to both call upon individuals wherever they are to just start killing Westerners indiscriminately. that was what was already going on in Europe. But for a long time, Al-Qaeda core held the franchise on America very jealously, and they didn't want those kinds of low-level attacks. For Al-Qaeda, America was Broadway, and they wanted to follow up 9/11 with another
bright lights,
spectacular.
Big city. Mm-hmm.
But they couldn't pull it off. Mm-hmm. And so for years, in some ways, our immunity from terrorism was simply the fact that Al-Qaeda couldn't stage another grand attack as they had long hoped to do.
Now, though, the call out for individual attacks and a new organization more or less in the lead, more callers for you. Jacob in Columbia, Tennessee. Jacob, you're on the air with Lawrence Wright.
Hi. I grew up in Mississippi, and I was in high school. I was 15 years old. Thanks for taking my call, by
the way. Sure, sure.
I was 15 years old on September 11th, and we were in school, and I didn't know what had happened until about 11 o'clock when parents started coming to get their kids. But after first period, after about 9 o'clock, like, no one was doing anything that they were supposed to. Teachers were just walking around. No one cared about the bells, and we didn't know what was going on.
The whole country was in shock. I mean, everybody remembers that, no question.
And so I didn't even see the news until later that night. We all went to church, and I just remember this, and I remember the media doing this, but even our youth pastor at the time, they played this montage of the footage and people falling from the buildings and the explosions. And it wasn't just one time through. They just did it over and over again for like 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And I think that type of, I mean, obviously everybody needs to be aware of what happened in the tragedy of that day. But my wife refers to this kind of thing as something like tragedy porn, where people just get caught up into this catharsis. And I think even our leaders, when they authorized George Bush to basically wage an undeclared war in the Middle East, like that kind of just indulgence in that just constant barrage of those images really drove us into having a very short time horizon. Like, we couldn't see past the next 5 years. And I think because of that, we gave all of this power to the executive branch and to the military of the United States just to go in there, and we thought that we were just going to stomp on them, and that would be it.
Jacob, do you have a question for Lawrence Wright out of the interesting observations? What about for Lawrence, who's with us?
I just want to know, basically, I had a question about, is there anything that, as journalists, that you think that the major media could have done maybe to be more responsible and to have had a longer time horizon? Because I believe that journalists are held to an ethical standard, as to the way they cover things. And it almost became like propaganda.
Let us pick it up, Jacob. And I appreciate your call. 15 years old at the time, and it's ended up looking to Jacob and his wife like tragedy porn with perhaps real policy implications. What do you think of that as someone who's written so much about all of this?
I was thinking while he was talking, when I was about that age, was the Kennedy assassination. And, similarly, the imagery, that went on and on and on. But, in that case, it was a procession that actually developed. You know, new things happened. And there was, democracy continued to unfold. And it's in a kind of grandeur, after all. And that didn't happen with 9/11. The trauma was so deep and probably made deeper by the repetition of the imagery that Jacob speaks of. And, I can understand his wife's perspective. On the other hand, I think the media, the press, after 9/11 rallied in splendid form. I mean, it was amazing. There's something about America that I just treasure. Is, at the beginning of 9/11, it's hard to credit this, but I did find a statistic that there were only 8 people in the United States that were majoring in Arabic as a language.
Seriously, that's kind of mind blowing. You were in Cairo as a young man already.
I had learned Arabic in Egypt, but mm-hmm. It never occurred to me that we were so poorly prepared in that special sense to understand that part of the world. And immediately, the whole country changed. The number of kids that began studying Middle East studies, and the number of people that fled into the army, started signing up, the number of people that joined the intelligence agencies, and the books and the media and all this sort of thing. The whole country began to cram, what is this phenomenon and what are we dealing with? That's unusual. And that's one of those wonderful things about our country. I do fault the press. I think we fell down on the invasion of Iraq. Yes, it was an intelligence failure of massive proportions. But I think the press could have done a much more skeptical and thorough job of investigating what was actually going on in Iraq and the likelihood of there being weapons of mass destruction. There were reports that this was not accurate, and they were not seriously examined. I think that we, mm-hmm. as an institution, we fell down, as did the intelligence community, on communicating with the American citizens what we were actually getting into.
But there was such a wave of patriotism wrapped up in almost an impatience or a sense of inevitability about that war. I mean, I remember doing show after show, raising the kind of questions that you're describing right there, and sometimes being mocked by others in the press, saying, let it go, let it go. Well, we saw where it led. We're talking to Lawrence Wright. His new book is The Terror Years. Neil in Clarksville, Tennessee. Neil, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and I hope you're having this is a good conversation. I'm ex-military, sir, mm-hmm. and I was in the military when this happened. And I was at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, which is an open base. Well, it was an open base.
Yep.
And when that happened, everything shut down, and we just automatically started shutting the base down. Nobody can come in. Nobody can leave.
Yep.
It went from a nice, like you said, safe kind of thing to like an armory. We was putting up cantina wire. We had everybody was getting weapons. We were all getting cantina wire out, putting it all over the road.
Yeah.
I mean, it was checkpoints everywhere. Because we have a major kind of like fairway road that goes through us, and that was shut down. Everybody's recalled, like I said, to the base, and we was on high alert. We're a rapid deployment, the 82nd Airborne is a rapid deployment unit anyway, and of course we had special forces there, so, we were on alert.
Do you miss the time, Neil? Do you miss the time before all the concertina wire and lockdown?
Oh, yes. I mean, it was so much easier. You can just, of course. You know, all you had to do is go where you need to go to. There were no, like I said, all the checkpoints, and they rebuilt so much of their base, as in ID card scanners and, like I said, stopping and checking all the cars and everything. Now that I'm here at Fort Campbell, it's the same way. You know, it's even the same way. You know, everybody's at the MPs at the gates and the checking all the cars and all the repetition to stop and go.
What do you learn from it, Neil? Does it feel like it's forever, or that we can work our way through this phase and get back to the kind of more open liberty that Lawrence Wright describes that you miss?
I would like it to be that way, but since 9/11, I don't think it's ever going to be that way again. Because a caller that was, you said a statement earlier, I remember as a child growing up in Philadelphia, going to the Liberty Bell and being able to go there and actually touch the Liberty Bell and, and keep on going and stuff. And now that thing's in like lock and key. You can't go nowhere near it. All you can do is look at it. And like you said, you got to take your shoes off and all kind of stuff. And the airports are just so different. It takes you, 100 years just to go to an airport compared to just walking through there and, and going in. I remember as a kid going to see the pilots and stuff, you just like ask the flight attendant, you talk to the pilot.
Sure.
They will come out there and talk to you. And
just poke your head in and say hi. Neil, our time is short before the break, but you take us back to all that. What a look at how we may get out of this. But do you believe we can get out of it, Lawrence Wright? Do you believe we can get back to that land of liberty?
Oh, I think we can if we keep it in our hearts as a destination. What I fear is that it'll be so forgotten by younger people that that ideal, like Camelot, will seem like a myth.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. With Rocket Mortgage, you can get approved for a mortgage in minutes using a phone or tablet. This completely online process uses cutting-edge technology to make getting a mortgage more convenient than ever before. Now you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button without the frustration of digging through stacks of financial documents. Info at quickenloans.com/onpoint, equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. 15 years this Sunday after the attacks of 9/11, we're talking about where America, the world, have come, where we are in the age of terrorism. My guest is Lawrence Wright. His new collection of essays is The Terror Years, from Al-Qaeda to the Islamic State, Pulitzer Prize winner, who's been maybe deeper and more out front than almost anybody else in reporting what went on and the aftermath, in the origins and aftermath of 9/11. You can join us this hour. What do you think? If there's a way back or forward to a calmer, safer world, what is it as we sit here in 2016, 15 years after those attacks? Lawrence Wright joins us from Austin, Texas, in New York City last night at the Commander-in-Chief Town Hall. Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton was asked by former Army Captain Ernie Young about how she would decide when to deploy troops. She said defeating ISIS was her number one goal. She would support Arab and Kurdish armies in the fight, but she also made this promise.
We are not putting ground troops into Iraq ever again, and we're not putting ground troops into Syria. We're going to defeat ISIS without committing American ground troops.
Without American ground troops. Donald Trump has talked a lot about his plan, unspecified, to deal with ISIS. He was pushed on that last night by NBC's Matt Lauer. Trump has said he'd convene a panel of generals now to submit plans to defeat ISIS. Matt Lauer went right at that.
Is the plan you've been hiding this whole time asking someone else for their plan?
No. But when I do come up with a plan that I like and that perhaps agrees with mine or maybe doesn't, I may love what the generals come back with. I will convene.
But you have your own plan.
I have a plan, but I want to be. I don't want to. Look, I have a very substantial chance of winning. Make America great again. We're going to make America great again. I have a substantial chance of winning. If I win, I don't want to broadcast to the enemy exactly what my plan is. And let me tell you, if I like maybe a combination of my plan and the general's plan or the general's plan, if I like their plan, Matt, I'm not going to call you up and say, Matt, we have a great plan.
Lawrence Wright, you say you didn't watch last night, but there you hear some of that right there, and I'm sure you paid attention over time. We've heard a lot of generals talking, especially in the last week, as different groups have come out for Clinton or for Donald Trump. I can't say that it's inspired a ton of confidence in me. Either in the Clinton camp or in Donald Trump's mind, do you see the framework, the proper or effective framework for a response that could begin to really steer us out of what you call the terror years?
When I was listening to that, it reminded me of Nixon saying that he had a secret plan to end the war in Vietnam. He used to pat his breast pocket as if the plan was
right
actually
here.
Yeah, right here. And of course, he didn't. I think if America's leaders would ask themselves before getting into these adventures, what is at stake for America here? What are our interests? I mean, there are many, many things that call us to action in the world, and certainly, you know, there's so much suffering in the world that we would like to alleviate. Sometimes our attempts to alleviate suffering or prevent tragedies actually creates more trouble and tragedy in the world, and especially for us. So we have to be extremely cautious about especially wading into parts of the world that we understand so poorly.
What are you suggesting there, that a kind of isolationism? We're told that in the global era we can't just stay home and we've got to be out there. How do we go out without leaving a mark?
Well, I think that we do have to contain terrorism as much as possible in the regions where it arises to keep it from coming in our direction. But a lot of the problems that we've created have been problems that we've made for ourselves. Let's just take the example of the Taliban, and which was host to Al-Qaeda. Now, the Taliban did not surrender bin Laden, and so we went in to try to get him, and we failed at that first attempt. But we then stayed and created a war in Afghanistan that really wasn't our war. And we will eventually leave that country, and the consensus inside the foreign policy establishment is that at that point the Taliban will take over Afghanistan once again. Well, then what was it all for? That's the kind of nice thinking that, you know, we can go in and remake a country in our image, and it'll be better, and thank us for it.
But we were told just after 9/11 that the reason Al-Qaeda came up was because we had ignored Afghanistan and let this fester for years after supporting the Taliban against the Soviets years earlier.
Well, we did ignore. We went in 1979 with the idea of arming the Afghan Mujahideen, and in order to give the Soviet Union its own Vietnam, and to some extent we accomplished that, and then we walked away from that, and what we left was a country that then turned immediately to civil war. So our participation in that, had perhaps some contribution in breaking the Soviet Union down, but it did leave such a wealth of chaos inside Afghanistan that the country still has not recovered.
But there's no sort of virginal beginning we can go back to here now. You've got this great chain of cause and effect, and we can debate exactly what they are. But how do you retreat from that once? You know, once the fire's burning,
I think we have an obligation in Afghanistan now that we have done so much damage to do what we can to help them stabilize. And I think we had that obligation in Iraq, but the Iraqi people, through their government, their democratic government that we helped them set up, told us to leave. And had we been able to remain there and with some kind of stabilizing force, I think it would have helped that country immensely. It was a mistake to go in, and it was unfortunately a mistake to leave.
Lots of people responding to your nostalgia for a time of liberty before 9/11. Peter says, On Point Radio's guest is making me long for America I never knew. Especially touches me because I'm a pilot. Lawrence Wright saying, let's not forget how life was. Let's keep it in our vision as a goal to get back there. Again, Sean in Amherst, New Hampshire. Sean, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Lawrence Wright.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Lawrence. My question is, how much of this new age of terrorism that we're in is due to fundamentalism, and how much more is rooted in just the growing gap between the rich and the poor globally? We look at our In this country, we're concerned about it, but in other countries, the gap is much worse, and there's no social mobility. I look at countries like Ireland, and, you know, Ireland had the struggles in the 60s and 70s, and there was terrorism. But as soon as prosperity came to Ireland, you know, in the 80s when digital came over and they had a tech boom, and even today, it seems when that prosperity came to Ireland, nobody was really interested in being part of the struggles anymore. There were other opportunities there. So,
Sean, let us pick that up. I'll take it to Lawrence Wright. And if I may, Lawrence, let me piggyback on that with here's a comment from a listener on our website. Hello Kitty says, responding to the question I had raised, why is the whole world a stage for terror? She writes, because we've pushed our Western culture and our neoliberalism on the whole rest of the world. We've taken so much, and what have we given back? Pollution, extreme poverty, no wonder people hate us. What about economic development, equitable development as an answer? What about this notion online here that, you know, there's some kind of imposition of inequity that has made us inevitably a target?
Well, these callers are all struggling to put a pin the tail on the donkey of the causes of terror. And there are so many, and none are clearly defined. I mean, if you start imagining all the possible root causes of terror, you can talk about poverty and lack of education, lack of opportunity, absence of jobs, gender apartheid in some Muslim countries, the heritage of colonialism. All of these are root causes. None of them by themselves can you say, aha, that is the cause of terrorism. The way I imagine it is that they're all part little tributaries of a river of despair that runs through the Arab and Muslim world. And so there are many, many reasons why terrorism arises. And I think that America and wealthy countries in general have a great obligation to try to create opportunity in countries that are suffering from that kind of despair. And imagine I just mentioned, you know, that those wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, $4 to $6 trillion, mm-hmm. That did nothing. They did the opposite of developing. They undeveloped countries that were already broken and poor. If we had that money available, we could do a lot of good in the world and for ourselves. And that is unfortunately lost. I think that America has a role to model a democracy to – and, of course, I imagine the rest of the world would look at us right now and wonder what I'm talking about.
You mean model it rather than export it George W. Bush style or try it?
I can't prove this, but I was in Cairo during the primaries when Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and John McCain were running for president. Mm-hmm. And I made a speech at Cairo University, which is where Barack Obama went right after he was elected.
Yes.
And I asked how many people here would vote for Hillary Clinton, and all these young women wearing hijabs raised their hand, and how many for Barack Obama, and how many for John McCain, one guy from the embassy. But they were all fixated on the American election, totally captivated by the energy and the ideas that were being thrown around. And I think that it was one of the main reasons, one of the drivers that led to the Arab Spring right after that. Unfortunately, the young people that I was speaking to, who later went into Tahrir Square, had no idea what to do next. They weren't mature enough. They weren't prepared. But I don't think the Arab Spring is over. And it's an unrealized, unconsummated dream inside the Arab world. And I think that is the hope for change. It doesn't come from us, except that we show them the possibility of nonviolent social change and how powerful that can be.
We have a listener calling for you from Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. Abdullah, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Lawrence Wright in Austin, Texas.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be with you. I'm calling because I was a college student during 9/11. And since then, I've traveled many of the Middle Eastern countries. And obviously, right now, I'm calling you from Riyadh. Mm-hmm. I would like to raise the issue that I've heard from many people in the region, which is of injustices that have happened here in the Middle East and then in the broader Muslim countries, that are people here view this as the main cause of terrorism rather than terrorism being an inherent aspect of the cultural or religious upbringing of people in this region.
Injustice as opposed to something
yes.
in the religion. Abdullah, let me take it to Lawrence Wright.
I am always a little resistant to the idea of injustice being the main cause of terrorism. I know that in the Arab world that this is a we constantly hear this, and yet when we talk about what injustice are we talking about? Well, you know, Israel and Palestine is one that is always pointed to. And that is a chronic problem. And there have been many attempts, especially by American leaders, to resolve that crisis. Injustice of colonialism. Well, that is a problem. And historically, it is, you know, but Saudi Arabia, for instance, was never colonized by Western powers. You can look at this idea, and it what I suspect is that it is a way of taking the cultural stigma off of our of Arab and Muslim countries for their own failures and laying it entirely at the feet of the West. I'm not saying that the West has not had sometimes terrible involvements in the Middle East, and I put the invasion of Iraq at the top of that list. That was a historic mistake, maybe the greatest foreign policy blunder in America's history. So yes, we've had that, but I especially bridle at the idea that it is simply injustice on the part of Western countries against Arab and Muslim countries. I think that Arab and Muslim countries are responsible for their own failures. Other countries have been colonized, and America is one of them. Other countries have suffered injustice. Other peoples have suffered. Look at the success of the civil rights movement in this country. People can overcome injustice, but it doesn't necessarily lead to terrorism. It is the response that has to be first of all, inculcated and justified by ideology, and that is, I think, where the Arab world and the Muslim world bear a significant responsibility.
We've just got half a minute. Where are we in the arc of the terror years? Are we halfway through? Do you have any idea? Is this the future? Is this the way it's going to be?
I think it is going to be like this for quite a while, Tom. And I don't think, you know, it's not necessarily going to be Islam. The idea of terrorism has taken root, and other groups and individuals will take it up for their own causes.
Lawrence Wright has written so compellingly about these years. His essays are collected in the new volume, The Terror Years, From Al-Qaeda to the Islamic State. Joined us today from Austin, Texas. Staff writer, of course, of the New Yorker magazine, Pulitzer Prize winner for The Looming Tower. Lawrence Wright, thank you very much for being with us today. Wonderful talking with you.
It's been my pleasure, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.